Warlock Holmes and the Boggart Valley Mystery. We were seated at breakfast one morning, my wife and I, when the maid brought in a telegram. She brought it to Mary, which she should not have done, for it was addressed to me. Still, I found the transgression entirely pardonable, as I was not certain little Sally could read. And she was, let us recall, 9 years old.
Wrong, wrong. This is not for me, Sally. This is from one of John's little friends.
Mary flipped it across the table to me, and as it happened to land face up, I could instantly tell she was mistaken. I put down my napkin. Well, I hate to correct you, darling.
No, you don't.
No, I suppose I don't. In point of fact, this message comes from the least little friend I have ever had. Unless I am much deceived, the syntax proves the author to be none other than Tor Grogson.
Is he that tall, brutish fellow who carried my empty treasure chest over so you could gloat at me when you opened it up the night you ambush-kissed me and proposed to me and ruined my life?
Which the reader may recognize was a bit of a weighted question. I got a lot of those in those days. But this one was better than most, for it had a one-word answer. Yes. I bent to examine the note. It ran as such.
He is innocent. You are smart. You come help, Torg.
Another little adventure?
Probably.
What do you say, dear? Will you go?
I really don't know what to say. I have a fairly long list at present.
Perhaps we could get Dr. Anstruther to see your patients while you are away.
Dr. Anstruther? Do we know a Dr. Anstruther? I could not recall ever meeting the man, but his name did strike me as familiar. Had I read of him? I seem to recall I might have read something of him in the papers. Recently. Oh, quite recently. In fact, had he not been mentioned in the morning edition I had finished not 10 minutes previously and slid across the table to Mary? To answer my unasked question, Mary's left index finger gave 2 purposeful taps against one of the front page articles. Wait, Horbercast Anstruther? The butcher of Bag Streetway? The man is accused of killing half his patients.
Exactly. Used. Nothing is proven. The man is still open for business, and according to this article, his patient schedule may have 1 or 2 vacancies, mightn't it?
And I suppose it would not disturb you if he chopped half my patients to death.
Should it? You've said yourself there's too many of them. And try as I might, I cannot remember any of them ever paying us anything.
Well, true.
Oh, do go. Bugger off out of this house and give me a moment's peace, why don't you?
Which, dear listener, I did. Grumbling all the way, I made my way out onto the street, hailed a taxi and drove to Scotland Yard, where I asked to speak with Detective Inspector Tor Grogson. He wasn't there. What his note had failed to mention was that he'd been assigned to the McCarthy murder case, one in which the defendant was regarded as so clearly guilty that only a 5-year-old child who'd had 1 too many mugs of whiskey would ever consider that outside help might be required. Well, or Tor Grogson, of course. The lads at the yard had a good heart laugh at his expense and apologized that my time had been wasted. And yet, whatever one might say about Grogson's intellect, the fact remained that he solved more cases than any other inspector. More to the point, he had an unflinching sense of honor. Though I knew his compatriot, Lestrade, had sometimes demonstrated no hesitation pinning a crime on an innocent party, this is a thing Tor could never do. To complicate matters, Grogson and Lestrade were handling the case together. So there was some danger that despite Grogson's best efforts, Lestrade might dump the blame on the obvious suspect, clean his hands of the matter, and go home. Did Grogson know something Lestrade did not? His instincts for crime were formidable, and his note had begun.
He is innocent.
Half an hour later, I found myself on a train bound for the scene of the crime, John Turner's farm. The constables had told me in Boggart Valley. I'd never heard of the place. This, it turns out, was because it was a small and unimportant fold in the ground out by the Woodside and Cheapside, abutting the Great Park at Windsor. In other words, not far, just a little west of London. When I arrived, I found Gregson waiting for me on the train platform, his arms crossed in vexation over his generous expanse of chest.
Arrgh! Why so long?
Because your note said to come, Torg, but it didn't say where. I naturally assumed you'd be at Scotland Yard.
Yeah.
By which he meant that my excuses were specious and served only to waste more time, I think. Anyway, we soon found ourselves on a whirlwind tour of all the pertinent sites, punctuated by reviews of the local newspaper's coverage of the crime and subsequent inquiries, which I will not relate. Not because I am trying to be difficult, you understand, but because I am trying to spare you. I have a concern for your patience, dear reader, and as I fully expect you to be reading this, in the wake of a world-shattering demon apocalypse, I understand your time is precious. Allow me to sum up what I learned. 1. Charles McCarthy had been a crusty, dislikable, Australian sort of fellow who lived, for reasons nobody could quite explain, rent-free at Hatherley Farm. This particular property happened to be one of the finest farms on the rather eye-poppingly large tracts of land held by John Turner. 2. Last Monday, Charles McCarthy returned from a visit to a nearby town, urging his driver to hurry, for he had an appointment to keep at 3 p.m. Said appointment was, and only I seem to find this odd, scheduled to be held by the side of Boggart Pool, which lay about 1/4 mile from the Hatherley Farm. Across a field of grass and bush and, you know, nothing special. From this meeting, he never returned alive. He was seen walking alone towards the pool by John Turner's gamekeeper and one local lady. 3. About 6 minutes later, the same two people saw Charles McCarthy's son, James McCarthy, heading in the same direction. The local opinion of James McCarthy was that he had always seemed not to be touched by the same defects of character that had troubled his father, and that though he was somewhat unlikely to produce any scientific breakthroughs or pen any particularly insightful essays, he was rather nice to look at. The difference in character between father and son was accompanied by an equal number of differences in opinion, and the two often fought. 4. Sure enough, about 15 minutes after James McCarthy was seen walking to the pool after Charles McCarthy, the 14-year-old daughter of John Turner's lodgekeeper, Patience Moran, burst into her home and told her mother she'd seen the two of them employing rather heated language toward each other. She'd seen James McCarthy raise his hand towards his father as if to hit him, and had run home to report that she was afraid the two men were going to fight. 5. Secondary, sure enough, just as Patience was finishing her tale, James McCarthy burst in to say that he'd just found his father beaten to death by the side of Boggart Pool, and would somebody please help? James McCarthy's right hand and sleeve were smeared with fresh blood. Not only did the men who accompanied James back to the pool find the body of Charles McCarthy lying face down with the left right portion of his skull beaten in, they also could not help but notice James McCarthy's rather bulky shotgun lying just a few paces away, clean, loaded, and ready for action. 6. Tertiary, sure enough, James McCarthy was promptly arrested. It would be fair to say things did not go well for him at Tuesday's inquest, which returned a verdict of willful murder and ensured that the magistrates who saw him on Wednesday opted to have him held until the next assize. Despite the early stages of the case, they made sure to ask James how tall he was and how much he weighed, to make sure they had the proper length of rope standing by. You know, just in case. 7. just as I was beginning to wonder how on earth Grogson could ever assume young James to be innocent, our deliberations were interrupted by Alice Turner. She found us at our hotel and launched into a diatribe regarding James McCarthy's unimpeachable character and certain innocence. For a moment, I supposed, Grogson may have fallen back to old ways and had only come to summon me because he was trying to impress the pretty young lady. Except she wasn't all that pretty. Now, don't get me wrong, as the only heir to a father who owned enough of the local countryside to be considered something of a private empire, she must have been quite the marriage prospect, even if she'd had one extra foot and 28 extra teeth. Still, Grogson treated her as nothing more than a confederate, the only other person to assume James's innocence. 8. There was a romantic connection between Alice and James. Though she made some attempt to hide it, it was clear to me that Alice Turner had grown rather accustomed to gazing longingly at James McCarthy's rugged, handsome face. The enjoyment of this process would be decreased, she reasoned, if James were to become dead. Indeed, the prospect of their marriage had been brought up by his father a few times, and certainly not deflected by young Alice, who had a dress concealed in a box in her closet for just such an occasion. Her own father seemed incensed by the idea she should marry James, despite the prodigious amount of time he himself spent in the company of the young man's father. As both of the old fellows were widowers, Alice found herself no mother whose opinion she could try to sway. Though her father's refusal to let them wed had disappointed Alice, it was nothing compared to the sadness she drew from James's indifference towards the idea. James, it seemed, had developed a habit of deflecting the topic whenever it arose. Alice, it seemed, had developed a habit of drinking sherry and crying in the seed shed. 9. These events had shaken the whole community, no doubt, but none more so than John Turner. He had been in ill health for some time, and following the news of his old acquaintance's violent demise, had taken to bed. A remarkable downturn followed, and now his life was despaired of. The day was fairly well along by the time I had gathered this wealth of testimony, and already I was tired. Though it had been only a few hours, the urge to return to Mary was particularly vexing that day. The more I tried not to think of it, the more my anxiousness at our separation grew into a nagging headache. Grogson's frequent, loud, grammatically incomplete attempts to add detail to the case did not help assuage this phenomenon. I was interested to know what Lestrade knew of the matter, yet despite Grogson's insistence he was in the area, we did not encounter him. We did, however, have a note to drive out to the nearby jail and interview young James McCarthy, which is where things got rather peculiar. To start with, the man was preternaturally handsome. He might have been merely superior if it were not for one contributing factor. He seemed to have no idea how attractive he was. Did James's shoulders bulge with sinewy muscle? Oh, well, in his mind, that was just handy for digging ditches and moving hay. Was his jaw tough and square? Good, that might help if ever a horse should kick it. Were all his teeth straight and white and gleaming? Oh, all the better for chewing undercooked potatoes. This strange ignorance of one's own allure, whether it appears in male or female, is enough to drive most eligible suitors mad with frustration and desire. When the jailer let us in, James was slouching smolderingly against the back wall of the cell.
Hello. Forgot what I was going to say for a moment. Ah, yes. My name is Dr. Jordan Watson. Inspector Grogson here seems to think you are innocent of your father's murder. Is that correct?
Sure.
Yes.
Grogson gave me a rough nudge.
See?
Well, yes, Torg, but I'll confess, I'd hope for a bit more to go on. Mr. McCarthy, what can you tell me about the scene of your father's death?
Already told them all I know. I'd just come home from a visit to Bristol.
For a man who was protesting his own innocence, there was something particularly guilt-soaked about the way he said, visit. I found it for future inquiry.
How long had you been away?
3 days. I'd got back just a minute before. Dad was gone and I had nothing to do, so I grabbed my old shooter and went out to get a rabbit or two.
So you weren't following your father to Bhagat Pool?
Nope. Rabbit Hutch is on the other side, that's all.
It was an extreme coincidence. Yet, if he was lying, he was doing it with the practiced coolness of a hardened criminal. I cocked my head with wonder.
Then, when did you realize your father was ahead of you on the path?
When he started shouting, "Cooey! Cooey!" I called out a hello and asked him what he was doing there, but he got pretty worked up to see me. Said I was crowding him, and couldn't a man get his privacy? And I said I wasn't crowding him, and I was looking for rabbits, and he said, "Leave." And I said, "No, you ain't the boss of the pond." And we sort of got into a row.
Yes, Patience Moran says she saw you. She says you raised your fist at your father as if to strike him.
Yeah, I guess I did. I feel just awful about it. That's why when they arrested me, I told them it's no less than I deserve.
Probably to the detriment of your legal defense. But here's the thing, Mr. McCarthy. Only a few minutes passed between when Patience left and when you must have set out after her. There would certainly have been enough time for you to kill your father, but very little time for much else. Can you tell me what happened?
Sort of. I stormed off. It's what I always did when Father got hot. I heard a bit of noise behind me, which I figured was just Pops letting off steam, kicking bushes and such. He'd do that sometimes, but it didn't sound quite usual, you know? Too many heavy, wet thuds and splashing. I almost kept walking, but, well, it just wasn't right, so I turned back, which is when I tripped over the grey cloth.
Grey cloth? I don't think anyone mentioned finding a grey cloth.
No cloth.
I looked back and forth between Grogson and McCarthy for clarification.
I only saw it for a moment. I mean, I'll swear I did. It looked like a cloak or a coat or something, but I didn't pay it much mind because that's when I saw Father lying there.
The flash of pain and regret that crossed his features seemed entirely genuine. Despite the ill history between the two men, the actual act of seeing his father lying mortally wounded seemed to have greatly affected young James.
How did you get blood on your sleeve?
I ran over there to check on him. He was trying to say something to me. Tell me something about a rat?
A rat?
That's what he said, I think. He tried to say it a couple of times, but then... then his words left him and...
And that's when you went to get the lodgekeeper?
It was the closest place.
And how do you account for your arriving so soon after Little Patience, having spent so much time at the scene of the murder?
Longer legs?
And did you see the strange grey cloth again?
Not that I can remember.
Indeed. Just one more question, Mr. McCarthy. Do you know anybody besides your father who spent a great deal of time in Australia?
Well, sure. John Turner. That's where they met, you know. In the gold fields west of Melbourne.
West of Melbourne, you say? Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. I promise to do my utmost to aid you in your case.
Grogson and I stepped back into the afternoon light.
See? In our scent, right?
I do believe he is.
What now?
I rather think I'd like to ask John Turner about the whole affair.
Got your handcuffs?
Capital, shall we?
John Turner's house was not so grand as I might have thought. It was certainly more than enough to accommodate an old widower, his daughter, and their servants. It just wasn't quite what I'd have expected for a man who owned half a county and wanted to remind everybody of the fact. We were met by Turner's butler. Mr. Turner, please.
The master is not currently receiving visitors at the moment. His attentions are currently engaged with the process of, well, dying.
A very reasonable response on most days. Yet this is official police business, and as it may reflect meaningfully on his legacy, Mr. Turner would likely want to deal with it before he goes. Please inform him of the extreme urgency of this interview.
Oh, very well. You can wait with the others.
Apparently, John Turner had a rather full schedule his last day on Earth. The butler led us up some stairs to a little antechamber just outside Turner's bedroom, where I found Warlock Holmes sitting on a bench beside Vladislav Lestrade, Scotland Yard's droopiest vampire.
Holmes, Lestrade, what are you doing here?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Holmes leapt to his feet.
What are you doing here? Lestrade, Grogson, I am disappointed in you. I thought we agreed Watson must never be involved in supernatural investigations. And now I find you've dragged him down to a valley jammed full of murder fairies? For shame.
I thought you said it was a boggart.
Well, nearly the same thing. You've got fairies, you know, and then pixies, who are fairies, but they're also a bit of a bastard. Boggart, as far as I understand the speech of the Fae, means partly fairy, total bastard. So they must be handled with some care.
The only thing that must be handled, Holmes, is a man named James who has murdered his father.
Oh, right by the side of the Boggart pool? Take my word for it. Anyone who doesn't think Charlie McCarthy was slain by evil fairies is a perfect dummy.
I'm afraid you're both wrong. The butler had gone inside Turner's chamber to announce us, but I did not want him to overhear what I was about to say.
I am ever more confident that the murderer is none other than John Turner, who now lies expiring in that very room.
Lestrade gave an audible scoff.
Ha!
So I began to lay out my case.
Look here. James and Charles McCarthy were both present at Boggart Pool. That much has been established. But what if there was a third man present?
There is no reason to suspect a third.
Ah, but there is. A third was expected. Let us recall that Charles McCarthy had an appointment at the pool with an unknown man. We do not know the identity of that person, but we know that McCarthy tried to call out to him with the phrase, "Cooey, cooey." Now, that's an odd sound in this part of the world, but it is a common way to hail somebody in Australia.
Ah, but nobody actually saw Charlie McCarthy utter this call. Anybody present may have made that noise, a noise which I believe James McCarthy misheard. It was, in fact, squee, squee, which, as everybody knows, is the war cry of the Northumbrian battle pixie.
Oh, really? Everyone knows that?
Yes, everybody.
Even Grogson had to shake his head at that one. He offered a comment that was, in the finest thread of his own deductive style, perfectly simple yet also incisive.
Tis not Northumbria.
He's got you there, Holmes. Besides which, I have more evidence of a third man's presence. Let us not forget the grey cloak.
Oh, no, please don't remind him of the grey cloak.
Aha! The grey cloak. That is what first caught my attention. It was during a simple visit from Lestrade, you see. He was telling me the tedium of his current case, which had no feature worthy of my interest until he mentioned the strange appearance and disappearance of the grey cloak. That was when I knew I must involve myself.
Why?
Well, because who do we know who wears a grey cloak?
Anybody, Holmes? Just anybody?
Herne the Hunter.
Who?
Herne the Hunter.
We continued to stare at him, uncomprehending.
Herne, the antlered king of night, leader of the wild hunt, with his grey cloak and his owl? Do you not remember your Shakespeare? Sometime a keeper here in Windsor Forest doth all the winter time at still midnight walk round about an oak with great ragged horns. And there he blasts the tree and takes the cattle. and makes milk-kine yield blood, and shakes a chain in a most hideous and dreadful manner. You have heard of such a spirit, and well you know, the superstitious, idle-headed eld received and did deliver to our age this tale of Herne the Hunter for a truth.
Holmes, did you just quote Shakespeare at us?
Did you just accurately quote Shakespeare at us?
Oh, I have always been a lover of theater, you knew that. And did you hear? The verse references Windsor Forest. That's where we are, right now.
We know where we are, Holmes.
Oh, then did you also know this is far from the only thing our beloved bard teaches us about fairies? We also learn that fairies sometimes take an interest in a comely man-child, if fair virtue's force perforce do move them. And I don't know if you've met James McCarthy yet, but let me tell you, he is a smoking hot pile of fair virtue's force. Might they not have acted on his behalf?
Yes, I saw, though I would ask that you entertain just for a moment the idea that the cloak might belong to a mortal man.
Yes, but it doesn't, though.
Well, it might.
Except that it doesn't.
Holmes, look. Let us say the cloak belonged to the man who Charles McCarthy was scheduled to meet at Boggart Pool. A man who wished him ill, and whom he met in Australia. Let us presume the man is in the area to keep his appointment. Yet, as he draws near the appointed place, he is surprised to find the two McCarthys arguing. Perhaps something was said to set him off. Perhaps the unknown man always intended ill. Whatever the cause, when James leaves, the criminal sees his chance to strike Charles. The old man is distracted, kicking bushes, making threats, and not paying attention to anything but his retreating son. Our murderer grabs the closest weapon he can find, likely a good-sized rock, approaches Charles McCarthy from behind and does the deed. And here is the catch. He discards his cloak so it is not in his way. The sounds of the scuffle bring James back. The murderer has time to conceal himself, but not his cloak. He had to wait until James was occupied with his dying father before reclaiming the cloak and making his escape.
It is possible, but not probable. So much stealth on the part of the murderer. Such a particular course of events. If one element is out of place, the whole story collapses. Here is a much more likely answer. James McCarthy bashed his father's head in with the butt of his shotgun.
Bah! 'Twas a fairy that did it. They can be quite mischievous, you know. Have you ever been walking down a deserted country lane when suddenly a pebble thwaps you in the back of the ear? You turn to look to see who threw it. No one is there. That is how the mysterious Boggarts let mortal man know they have not yet abandoned this world.
Except he didn't get thwapped in the ear, did he, Holmes? He got the back of his skull crushed.
Well, it must have been a big one, then.
It wasn't a big fairy. It was the back of a gun.
Except that it demonstrably wasn't. The gun was clean. No blood on the stock. No bits of hair and skin. The idea that it inflicted so terrible a wound and stayed pristine is risible.
Oh, you think it was a rock. I know. So then, why did we not find your blood and hair-covered murder rock, eh?
Because the murder took place next to a pond. If you had just killed a man and found yourself standing with a blood-stained rock next to a pool of water, what would you do? Rocks are not known for their buoyancy, after all, and let us remember that James McCarthy reported hearing splashing.
Your mysterious Australian murder man theory makes no sense.
Oh, I think it makes a great deal more sense than James McCarthy killing his father.
Why? They often fought.
Then let me ask you, Lestrade. Did James intend to murder his father by the pool that day?
Why not?
Because if he had planned the murder, he'd have planned his story. And yes, 4 points for creativity and the disappointing reappearing cloak and all that. But here's what his story does not do. It in no way exonerates him. Instead, he keeps saying, I probably deserve it, and I can't explain what happened. Does it seem like a prepared alibi to you?
Well, he is a bit stupid.
Not that stupid. He's not an imbecile. He's just a plain fellow, and I suggest we consider the notion that he may be dealing plainly with us.
Yeah, Torg thinks so.
Grogson gave me a supportive shoulder slap and sent me sprawling against Holmes. Lestrade gave a little smile at my rough treatment.
Or perhaps his story is so rudimentary because he did not have it prepared. Perhaps it was a crime of passion.
I pushed myself off Holmes and gathered as much dignity as I could.
That makes even less sense. A crime of passion. If that were the case, then in his moment of fury, James would not only have to resist shooting his father with the loaded gun he was currently holding, he'd also have to have the foresight to avoid clubbing him with it. Do you think that's what happened? Do you think he set his gun carefully aside and went to look for a rock?
Or a fairy?
And let us remember that the wound is to the back of Mr. McCarthy's head on the left-hand side. It's hard to surprise someone from behind when they're having an argument. And unless the attack was a backswing, the murderer is most likely left-handed. Now, is John Turner left-handed?
He has two hands.
Damn, I was hoping someone would know. I would have looked awfully smart just then. I bet he is, though.
Why do you keep thinking it's John Turner? The man is a dying invalid.
It's to do with Charles McCarthy's final words, Lestrade. James said he was trying to find something about a rat.
A fairy name. Rikki-tikki-ratty. Ratagast. Ratatouille.
You just made those up.
Except for the one that is a French vegetable stew.
Well, what do you think it means then, Mr. Smarty?
James McCarthy said his father met John Turner west of Melbourne, Australia.
So?
West of Melbourne. Ballarat.
Grogson reacted as if my final point erased all doubt. Which, I will admit, it did not. Both Holmes and Lestrade seemed still willing to press their theories, but Grogson's exuberant display robbed them of their chance. Even as the echoes of his roar faded, the long-absent butler burst back through the door.
What noise is this? I don't know if you cretins remember it, but there is a man dying in that room. What possibly could be so important that you must argue it with such vigor right outside a deathbed chamber?
I did not care for his tone.
To be honest, he was discussing if your master is Charles McCarthy's murderer, or if the whole thing was done by fairies.
Get out! Leave this house! My master will not see you!
Unacceptable, I'm afraid. Grogson, please inform this fellow that yes, in fact, we will be seen.
This Grogson accomplished with a single backhanded swat that sent the butler rocketing across the antechamber until he smashed into the stairway railing. The collision knocked free all the man's breath, all the man's half-digested lunch, and no small quantity of blood. The only rebuttal the unfortunate butler mounted was to curl up into a ball and roll insensibly down the stairs.
It looks as if my list of patients that won't be paying for my services just increased by one. But that's a concern for a later hour. For now, to business, gentlemen.
Inside the chamber, we found John Turner lying on his bed, surrounded by a magnificent pile of cushions and one whisker sprout of a country doctor who seemed to have no other course of treatment prepared than to sit and wait for the inevitable. Which is not to say he was wrong. Both of Turner's legs had swollen to prodigious size. He was pallid and gray. His every breath seemed to be a trial for him, and his eyes bespoke a profound and insurmountable lethargy. I'd seen it before. Even from across the room, I could diagnose him. Kidney failure. Nothing to be done. Some incense had been lit to keep the smell pleasant, but the thing that really stood out was the collection of large gray stones spread out in what I suppose was meant to be a decorative arrangement. But then, there is no accounting for taste, they say. Turner's eyes rose to meet us as we walked in. and he summoned with great effort something of the masterful air that was his habit.
All right. Gentlemen, what's the meaning of this intrusion?
We want to know why you killed Charles McCarthy.
Well, that's inconvenient.
Then, realizing what he'd said, he gave a sudden start and turned to his doctor.
Alice, is she here?
No, sir. You did not wish to see her for your final moments. Don't you remember? Your farewells have been said. She is gone.
Well, thank God for that. Don't mind hearing all this mess, do I? You go too. Thank you for your help, but bugger off.
But sir, you may have only minutes.
Well then, what good are you doing anyway? Go on. Out with you. All right. How did you figure it out?
What a moment. Lestrade forgot all caution in hiding his fangs and let his mouth droop open. Holmes, I must say, looked rather crestfallen. I'm sure if he'd known this would only be a matter of people killing people with no Fey involvement, he'd have stayed at home. It was the cloak, chiefly. Young McCarthy spotted it as he returned to his father's side. But before he rose again, it was gone. As I read it, you discarded it to do your mischief, then spirited it away while James was distracted.
It wasn't easy. I don't move as quick as I used to, you know. But it's hard to go without a cover nowadays. These old bones get cold.
What I don't understand is this. After so many years of living so close to Charles McCarthy, what suddenly induced you to kill him?
It's because I heard what he and that dreaded son of his were arguing over. I don't suppose James McCarthy told you about that, eh? Didn't tell you about his little visits to Bristol, did he?
Not in detail.
Poor bastard. He's a handsome lad, ain't he? Attracted the eye of some scheming barmaid a few years back. Got all tangled up with her. Got married, in fact. Tried to keep it secret, but we all knew. His father, that black goat, always had the gall to assume young James would marry my Alice. Seemed to think it was a fine way to rob me of all I had once I was gone. But then, since we all knew James was married, it seemed like the joke was on him.
Well then, what changed?
That day at the pool, Charles told James what he just found out. That Weasley little barmaid was already married. And, seeing as she's not allowed more than one, James had never been quite so spoken for as he'd thought. So now the joke was back on me again. James is not such a bad fellow, I guess. But he is his father's son. That's enough. I'd never let that man's foul blood mingle with my own. I had to do something.
You could have simply said no.
But that's just it. I couldn't. Don't you see? Charles McCarthy had been blackmailing me for years.
Which explains why he lived rent-free.
On my best land.
And, unless I miss my guess, because of something that happened in Ballarat, Australia.
Yes. I've no idea how you guessed it, but I was a bushranger. You know what that is?
Something like a highwayman, isn't it?
Something very like a highwayman, yes. The Bull Rat Gang, they called us. Used to hold up the stagecoaches from Goldfield and take all they had. Wasn't easy work, mind, as they always went guarded. Charles McCarthy was one of those guards. Oh, sometimes a rover and a robber, no doubt. There's many of us who walked whichever side of the fence the money was on, one week to the next. But the day we met, he was on the right side of the law and I was on the wrong. The robbery went bad. We blew the surprise. They heard us, I think. There were six of us when we first set out, and only five of them. But their first volley cleared half of us out of our saddles. We fired back. And we gave them right hell, but the odds were against us. Finally, there were none alive but McCarthy and me. There I was, shot through the leg and in the side. Leaning up with my back against a great grey rock with no bullets left in my gun and no strength to drag myself to my dead friends to borrow more. And that's when I heard him for the first time. The spirit in the greystone.
I think I must have made a bit of a face. Lestrade's jaw dropped another notch. Grogson looked deeply puzzled. Holmes, it must be said, perked right up.
A fairy? A boggart?
Boggart. That's what he called himself. The bog-hearted boggart of Bollerat.
Yes, I love him.
Said he'd mind to cut a deal with me, so long as I deal with him. He said he'd get me out safe and sound with all the gold, so long as I pledge my troth to him and give him a kidney.
A kidney?
He said he'd be all right, as a man may live without a kidney. And there I sat with no bullets and no choices. So I gave it to him.
Ooh, did it hurt?
Not at all. He magicked it out, I guess. Never felt a thing. Next I knew the air was alive with flying stones. I never thought I'd see a thing like that. One of them dashed McCarthy on the head and down he went, senseless. I almost shot him as he lay there. By God, if only I had. But there's a sympathy you feel when you know it should have been you that died that day. I let him go. But I took that gold. And it was a pretty share, too. Made my way clear the country and bought up all this land out here. I even got a special dispensation from the Crown to name this place Boggart Valley, after Boggart.
Oh, what did it used to be?
Boscombe of all stupid things. I thought the whole thing was behind me. But wouldn't you know, that bastard McCarthy went back to the same site a few years later to figure out what happened. He put himself behind that same old rock and wondered aloud what had passed.
And Boggart, the bog-hearted boggart of Ballarat, told him.
Backstabbing bastard fairy. Yes, he did. 6 months later, McCarthy showed up here talking about what a fine law-abiding country England was. How there was always a constable on hand when there was one needed. And he lived here on my land ever since.
Until you heard his son was free to marry your daughter. Until you picked up a stone and dashed his head in. Oh, and you're left-handed, aren't you?
Well, sort of. I mean, I am left-handed. Most fellows who can hear a fairy are, you know. But I don't have the strength to go crushing any skulls nowadays. I just squeezed my eyes shut real tight and thought, Boggart, you rotten sprite. This is all your fault. You told me you'd make things right, so why don't you do it? And I heard a little whisper in my head. Even after all those years, he was still with me. Said he'd take care of McCarthy once and for all. And all he wanted...
was your other kidney. Well, I suppose that explains the sudden downturn in your health.
What? Oh, there is no relation. A man may live without a kidney.
Yes, a kidney. One. But a man may not live without both kidneys.
Both? What do you mean, both? Are you trying to imply that man has not but two kidneys?
Well, yes. A worried look began to steal across John Turner's face, but he tried to play it off.
Bah! Have you ever considered how many kidneys a man might regrow over the long years of his life?
None.
Oh? Oh.
A look of profound disappointment crossed his features. All the strength seemed to leave him. He slumped in his bed, gave a sad, tired shake of his head.
Stupid fairy. Ugh.
And slipped into that dreamless sleep, from which he never awakened.
Idiot.
And I might have said more, if it were not for all of a sudden that one of the head-sized grey rocks flung itself across the room. I leapt aside. But poor Torg was caught entirely by surprise. The rock smashed into one side of his face at 30 or 40 miles per hour. I think the force was more than sufficient to batter down a fortified prison door.
Ow!
Grogson rubbed at his cheek. For those of us who are not quite so durable, matters were far worse. The rocks came at us from all sides.
Look out! He's not up here!
Yet the particular provenance of my antagonist did not trouble me nearly as much as the few hundred pounds of stone assailing me from all sides. Lestrade's eyes went wide for a moment, but when it came right down to it, Lestrade was a vampire, and vampires are quick. He zipped this way and that, avoiding all harm, wearing an expression more of wonder than of fear. Grobson took a few hits, but the more common outcome was for him to catch one of the incoming projectiles and fling it through the nearest wall with twice the force it had before. Holmes seemed to be enjoying himself immensely. And his burning black soul blade appeared in his hand. The next time a rock came at him, he sidestepped and swung his mighty weapon, and the hapless rock was struck in twain, even as it flew. Which was not helpful, if I'm honest. I mean, it's not as if he stopped the thing. Now there were two pieces of rock hurtling about. And as a special bonus, though it had been rounded before, now it had sharp edges. Plus, if I did not have enough to try and keep my eyes on, now I had to worry about Holmes flailing about with a god-killing weapon. Like a happy young boy with his favorite stick. Sure, a good hit from one of those rocks might end it, but the slightest touch from Mel's frizzle most definitely would. I dipped. I dodged. I whirled. I got my left leg all tangled up with my right one and went down. Like a drunken moose. My face bounced off John Turner's floor with enough force to bloody my nose and set my head whirling. Half stunned, I rolled over onto my back. There, hovering near the ceiling above me, was the biggest, grayest rock of them all.
Cheeky bugger!
He'd just been waiting for his chance, and he flung himself down at me. Dazed from the fall, I had no time to dodge it. I didn't even manage to get my arms up to ward off the blow. Instead, Holmes lunged towards me and thrust Melvrasoth forward. The ebon blade struck through the center of the falling stone, impaling it and stopping it just a few inches above my face, which, of course, it should not have been able to do. But what of physics when Holmes was in the mood? The black blade sang with the impact.
Great! Thanks for that!
But Holmes didn't hear me.
Orcarot! Orcarot! Your name is known to me! Cease this outrage!
The rocks hesitated for a moment, then clunked down to the floor.
You have killed my chosen mortal!
And you know, he did sound more Northumbrian than Australian. Which is not to say he sounded particularly reasonable.
Wait just a minute. You killed your chosen mortal.
What do you mean?
You took both his kidneys.
I was hungry.
That's no excuse.
Bogharat, the bog-hotted boggart of Ballarat, did not seem to have appreciated being spoken to in such tones. The rocks hovered up once more, ready to renew their onslaught. I had no idea what to do. Holmes, however, did. How should one handle a Shakespeareish fairy? With Shakespeareish threats. Holmes straightened to his full height, and he spake.
I see you, O illustrious knavish sprite. I think not well of what you do today. A callous sport, flinging baleful stones and chasing all my noble friends away. But hear me, ere you chance your foolish game, and learn of me the fearsome hidden cost that will perforce bring on you such sharp grief if thou continue doing what thou dost. Yea, I shall blight the stone and damn the earth with seedling discontent and rotting wrath. The mare shall heed no more the shrieking foal, and lovers change their hearts and break their troth. The apricocks and dew leaves cancerous waste, the field no longer furrow to the hoe. Then all the fay shall name thee with the blame, and shake this weary valley with their woe.
Around us, the hovering rocks bobbed indecisively for a moment, then a moment more.
You warden!
Oh no! You just keep on misbehaving, mister, and see what you get.
fane.
Including the one that had been silently maneuvering itself up over Holmes in the hope of dashing down on him unexpectedly. It plummeted from the ceiling onto Holmes's right foot.
Ow! Oh, by the 12 gods! That bastard fairy!
Squee!
And the spirit of Bergeret faded back into the fey.
Well, I think I'm going to count this as we were both right. Now, we'd better take a look at that foot, Holmes.
No, I'll fix it myself.
What? You're not a doctor, Warlock.
And you are not a boggart fighting guy.
Holmes turned to Grogson and Lestrade.
We're not involving Watson in any further cases. Is that clear?
When neither of them answered...
Is that clear?
Fine.
As you wish, I suppose.
Good. Because Watson needs to stay safe. And as for you, John, get out of here. Right now. Go on. March. And as a special favor to me, do try not to get killed on the way home, eh?
Burning with shame and anger, I turned to go. Lestrade refused to meet my gaze, though I could not tell if he was sulking because he did not like to have his hand forced, or because he'd let his case go so very wrong. My only consolation came from Torg, who gave me the smallest nod as I left. He was always one who could say more with his gaze than his words. Because of you, James McCarthy will escape the noose. The life that would have ended now shall flourish. Perhaps if fortune smiles, flourish alongside Alice Turner. Or, to put it another way, yeah, you did good.